went to the Greek islands. It was nice. Did you go to that nice taverna? Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Geordie. How you going?
I'm all right. How about yourself?
I'm great.
Are you Greesh?
I'm always Greesh.
You're always Greesh.
Greesh. Our listeners can't see you, but I would say your hair is looking Greesh.
Oh, thanks. I had a nice compliment from one of our eavesdroppers the other day on our social media saying my flicks were on point. Thank you, Shari.
Shari's on it with the flicks.
She likes my flicks and she's got great flicks too, so I felt very honoured.
I've been thinking about flicks because obviously I tried to cut my own hair.
Flicks.
And it ended up a slight flick, not really a flick, but I cut it too far.
I can only see forehead, no flick right now.
Well, that's because I'm growing out the flick because I fucked up the flick.
Okay.
I cut it too far. Right. I ended up with mushroom hair.
Boof.
Mushroom head, yeah. And it's not good. I'm thinking I need a professional to
Well, you can go into the professional hairdresser and say, hi, I'd like flicks, not the boof or the mushroom. These are all very technical terms that I'm sure only a hairdresser would understand.
Exactly. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to go armed with my terminology. Thank you very much.
Great. And hopefully you'll get a fantastic haircut at the end of it. Michelle, I feel like this is a very good segue to say hello and welcome to Eavesdropping or Eavesdropping the podcast. My name is Geordie.
And I'm Michelle. And you're listening to us, which makes you an eavesdropper. Yes, indeed.
Have you ever been accused of being an eavesdropper? And how did that make you feel? Did you feel embarrassed and ashamed? Well, you shouldn't. You shouldn't. Not this time.
No.
Because we're encouraging it.
We are encouraging it. I love an eavesdrop. I love to eavesdrop. I love eavesdropping.
I do.
I do it all the time.
Titbits. I'm currently in Australia. They love to eavesdrop on a conversation, the Aussies. They almost feel like any conversation that's had within earshot is there for them to comment on.
Has this happened to you?
It has. I can't remember exactly, but it did make me think, and that's why I've got a podcast called Eavesdropping. Because I'm so interesting, people just want to have a
part. Do you know what? I am turning into the old lady who goes, oh, they're listening to a conversation. Oh, well, blah, 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 and just jumps in. I did it the other day.
Right.
I did it.
I went to the Greek islands. It was nice. Did you go to that nice taverna?
Oh, my God.
The one with the fish on the front. It was really nice.
It was delicious.
What did we have? Andreas, what did we have? We had that salad. Do you remember with the cheese in?
The white one, the salty white
What's
one.
That called?
Feta. It's the feta cheese.
Feta. But listen, we're getting off topic. Let's just say thank you once again to our eavesdroppers for being a part of our ride, a part of our show.
I know. We love that you come along for a sweet ride with us. And
absolutely.
We've had some comments on the Patreon, actually. We've had some new sign-ups, some new comments.
Have we?
Oh, yes, we have. And
Hit me.
Yeah, one comment from, it was actually on the picture of you holding a ciggy.
With my fag.
Yes, yeah. People love that. It takes them right back to the good old days where you'd go out and come home smelling like an ashtray.
Oh.
I mean, I don't miss those days, to be honest.
I don't. No, I'm glad. I just wish I'd gone back and told myself, you don't look cool, stop smoking. What do they say about me?
That's it. They just, it's all reminiscent. Not about you.
It's about the ciggies. The good old days when you could smoke a fag inside. Yeah.
Yes. And we did actually have a voice note.
And actually, I've got it here to show everybody because it was regarding that wonderful episode 14, two ago, where you talked about out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences. And one of our most prolific researchers and listeners, Safka, the White Witch.
Our gorgeous White Witch, yes.
She got in touch because she had a near-death experience, Michelle.
Let's have a listen.
Here we go.
Hello, lovelies. Just thought I would write. What am I saying? I'm not writing. I'm talking. Talk to you after your fabulous podcast today on NDEs and OBEs. I just want to tell you about mine. I don't know if you know this, but I have a pacemaker that was put in 2017 as I had complete heart block. So what happened was I was in the bathroom and woke up on the other side of the bathroom on the floor. During this time, I kind of went into this really dark, bleak place where I felt like I was being ripped apart and I felt like hands were pulling me down. It was the most horrible feeling, and I was desperately trying to get to the top to get air. It was almost like I was drowning. It was a weird feeling. When I woke up, I was on the floor and I just was terrified, and I just felt really, really sad and horrified, and it was a horrible thing. And I think what had happened was my heart went into complete heart block, so it pretty much wasn't beating on its own, and then it came back. So I think I must have blacked out and then come back, but it was just the most horrific experience. So after that, I got a pacemaker put in. And I'm okay now. But just when I was passing out, I had a few weeks of constantly passing out from having heart block and not knowing I had it. I just had the most horrific experiences of feeling like these evil things were pulling me down and trying to trap me and not letting me back. And then I'd kind of come to the surface and just feel so violated and frightened. It was, really weird. Hopefully when I die, that won't happen again. I just wanted to let you know that it was a really good episode because it just kind of gave me some reassurance. So thank you. I appreciate it so much. And I hope you guys are well, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye, my darlings.
What do you make of that, Michelle?
Well, first of all, holy fucking shit that A, her heart stopped, B, she now has a pacemaker. Thank goodness, because it's wonderful technology.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
And the fact that she didn't have the, come to the white light. She had this really, really dark experience. So
poor girl.
But I do like that she said at the end that, you know, we've given her some reassurance. So that was very kind.
That's good.
Very nice. Thank you so much, Safka. And
yes,
we are very, very happy to hear that you are doing well and all's fine with this pacemaker.
We're thrilled with that. Keep on keeping on and keep on writing in and voice noting us. That's not just to you, Safka. It's for everyone. You're all allowed. Go for it.
You are all allowed. We absolutely love it. Now, I will say, actually, harking back to that episode where we did talk about, well, that was the near-death experience. I'm talking about last week's episode where we talked about missing persons. The very top of the episode, Geordie.
What did I do?
No, it was me. And I feel absolutely awful about this because I feel like I might have negatively manifested after last week's podcast, because I flippantly said, no new deaths on the mountain, blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
And then
There was.
Fucking grim turn of events. I had people from all over the world texting me saying, oh my God, just heard on the news about the avalanche in Zermatt. Are you okay?
Oh God.
I was actually out skiing just above that avalanche. They were off-piste, were the people who died in the avalanche. They weren't meant to be there. It was an illegal part of the piste. And Andreas had skied down and he'd come back up and said, there are all these tracks. People are skiing there. Do they not realize this is high avalanche danger? An alert had gone out. Avalanche level 4, you know, the highest is level 5. Then there was a massive avalanche. Like I said, I was actually skiing the bit above, and it was just awful.
Mm.
You know, 3 people were killed. 1 was injured. 1 is still missing. They've still got all avalanche dogs up there trying to find this person. The whole town is in shock. The whole world is, like, I think, understanding that the mountains are really powerful. And I feel really bad because I was just so flippant, like, death's on the mountain. Yeah. And then it fucking happened.
You weren't to know me.
I know, but I feel, I'm so sorry, universe. I actually feel traumatized by what happened, and I can't stop thinking about it. So now I just need to have good vibes. No more deaths on the mountain ever, please. Universe, thank you very much.
My God, that's shocking. It's shocking that that can happen on your doorstep.
It's awful because obviously a lot of people in town know one of the people who died.
Yeah,
just be careful on the slopes, people. So moving right along.
Okay.
Because I find that quite dark.
Yeah, it's dark.
It's not as if the content matter for this week is bright sunshine and happy days because
no,
we're looking at cults.
Well, you're looking at a cult. I'm looking at a scam, Michelle, because we had somebody write in. It's Charlene, who is our little happy chappy
yes.
from the UK that writes in. And she's always the one that says how great the episodes are.
Thank you.
It's great. She asked if we'd ever heard of this particular scam that I'm going to talk about later. But when I brought scams up, my mum, who obviously I'm staying with at the moment, said she almost fell for that my phone is broken, mum. Call me back on this different number and send me money scam.
Oh, my God, the hi mum scam.
She did. She fell for the hi mum scam. And what happened was, I was thinking, well, which child did you think it was? You know, I'm in London. It couldn't be me. But she assumed it was my brother when she got the message saying, hi, mum, my phone's broken. Can you please call me back? Or can you please send me some money or something like that? I can't remember what she said it was. But it's the same old usual one.
Yep.
And she assumed it was my brother. She wrote back saying, well, how did you break your phone? And at this point, my dad's there with the bank card ready to go
yeah.
to pay the money.
Oh, my God.
Which he did pay some money.
What?
But it was into my brother's account.
Oh, smart.
You see, straight away they pinged the money over without thinking. In that time that it took for the caller to respond by saying, it fell in the toilet. She thought, that doesn't sound like her son.
Mm.
That doesn't sound like a thing that my brother would do. So thankfully, it wasn't as bad as it could be.
And your brother got a bit of cash out of it.
My brother just got a surprise little lump of cash.
Well, do you know what? Smart. At least he didn't say, and I've got a new bank account. And just send me your maiden name, Mum. And it's a, and your PIN number.
And your PIN number.
Bless. Do you know what? I think it's easy. I think it's easy to fall for these scams. But I don't have a scam today. Well, do you know what? It is kind of a scam.
What have you got?
This week, I'm going to mini dive into a cult that I didn't know anything about until I listened to a podcast series called A Very British Cult.
A Very British Cult.
On the BBC by a journalist called Katrin Nye. I think she's done things before. She's a young journalist doing, you know, quite a few investigative pieces.
Okay.
This one is about a group called Lighthouse.
All right.
So Lighthouse, I mean, great name, mm-hmm. actually.
Except don't call the band Lighthouse Family. That just makes me cringe. I hate that band.
Yeah.
Like M People.
M People. What do you think the M stands for?
Motherfuckers.
Motherfuckers?
Almighty voice.
Oh, my God. M People. Haven't people said that you sound like M People?
No. No. If they have, then I hate you.
Well, I think if you're going to have a cult, Lighthouse is a pretty good name.
Okay.
I would say it's easier than Nixium.
Yes, I agree with that. Yeah.
It's basically one of those self-help life coaching organizations that reel you in with their shtick, which is, you know, they will help you realize your full potential. You can achieve your dreams. And they do this by getting you to buy courses from them.
Yes.
One-on-one coaching, mentoring, mm-hmm. which they say if you, you know, pay this money and do all this, you'll be successful in your personal life and in business.
Okay.
So a little bit like Nixium,
yes,
actually.
Yes, it does sound like that, doesn't it?
Mm. The podcast kicks off with a guy called Jeff Lee Jones, who has this.
It sounds like he's saying his name wrong. Sorry to interrupt. Jeff Lee.
Jeff
Hello,
Lee.
Jeff Lee.
Jeff.
Sorry. Hi, my name's Jeff Lee Jones.
Jeff
No, that's Jeff Lee, not Jeffrey.
Jeff Lee. Jeff Lee.
Jeff Lee.
Sorry. Sorry. Okay, let me. It's so funny because I hadn't even thought about that. I was just like, Jeff Lee Jones. Jeff.
Lee Jones. Right, gotcha.
And it's a Lee with a G-H. So Jeff.
Huh?
Lee Jones.
Oh, okay. Lee.
Lee Jones.
Okay, gotcha.
So let's just call him fucking Jeff.
Lay?
He's, yes, right. Yes. We're just calling him Jeff from now on.
Yeah, it's gone wrong.
Look, he had this kind of desire to sail to the South Pole, and it was his big thing he wanted to do. He, during the pandemic, joined this online book club, 2020, and the guy who ran the book club was a guy called Jay Singh.
Oh my God.
I know. I knew you were going to have another fucking comment about my pronunciation.
I'm not even going to say it. I think everybody listening knows where I'm going to go with that. So I'm just not going to do it.
Don't go there. So do you know what? I'm going to spell this shit out. J-A-I. J.
J-A-I.
Sing.
That's Jai.
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 J?
J-A-I is Jai.
Jai. Jai-sing.
Jai-sing.
Jai. That's the icing on the cake, Geordie. It's the icing on the cake.
Well done. Touché, Michelle.
Jai? You know I'm going to call him Jay the whole fucking episode.
Just call him Jay.
That's what it's. Let's that's what I've been thinking when I've been writing this down.
Okay.
Jay, sing, S-I-N-G-H. Another J, another G-H.
Okay.
G-H there. Yeah. We got that down?
Yeah.
So this guy, Jay, he recommended that Jeff... Jeff and Jay, Jai wanted Jeff to, after they got friendly on this in this bloody book club, he was like, why don't you check out Lighthouse? You know, could be something for you.
Yeah.
Because if you want to sail around the world and go to the South Pole and you, you know, this life coaching could really get you more focused on your dream and give you the discipline you need. So, yeah, Jeff signed up to Lighthouse because he wanted to be inspired by someone who was already successful. And Jay, who was a former property developer in his late 30s, had made a real impression on Jeff. You know, after their chats, they seemed to have the same ideas about success and discipline. And Jeff thought Jay seemed like a super smart businessman. And he and Jay began talking on the phone about business. And pretty soon those calls were daily calls that lasted hours.
Absolute seduction.
Yep. Jeff's girlfriend Dawn was like, what the fuck is going on here? But Jeff was really excited about it because he felt like he'd met this kindred spirit. Little did he know, and this came out like, you know, way after, Jay actually was not this super successful like guy. He was basically in Lighthouse living on a dirty mattress in a shared house, like just awful, awful shit. And he's in his late 30s during this. But like I said, bit by bit, these conversations got longer and longer. And they started not just talking about business stuff and success and all of that. It got personal. And Jeff started talking about his past, his personal life, his relationship with Dawn, his parents, his family. And he, at the time, felt like it was really great to be able to talk to someone about this kind of personal stuff because I think he was a bit of a buttoned up guy. And talking about all of this just seemed to kind of focus him on what he wanted to do in life. And Jeff said it was brilliant at first. Within a month or two, he was forking out £10,000 to Lighthouse for a year-long mentoring course with Jay that Jay promised would help Jeff improve his discipline and get him on the path to doing not just his solo sailing trip, but anything he wanted in life.
Oh, dear.
And Jeff was really motivated. You know, he was loving it and felt really inspired and like the 10K was an investment in himself. Like all good pyramid schemes.
Mm-hmm.
A few months later, after Jeff had shelled out the 10 grand for this year of mentoring, Jay then offered him the chance to get in on a new opportunity to succeed at Lighthouse. And not everyone was offered this chance, Geordie. Jeff was special.
Right.
And it was only going to cost him £25,000.
Oh my God. Who has that money though?
Well, that's the thing. Jeff did. But Jeff shouldn't delay in making that decision to like spend the money because the price was soon going to go up. So you had to do it now. Buy into Lighthouse now.
Yeah.
And even though it seemed like a lot of money, Jay said to Jeff, it was peanuts compared to what Jeff was going to make back with all the new business opportunities that were sure to follow after he spent this money. Basically, Jay told Jeff it was the best opportunity for him to succeed. So he handed over the cash and became a Lighthouse associate elect, which gave him exclusive access to the best minds at Lighthouse. And having this access to Lighthouse's network of kind of fancy entrepreneurs was really exciting for Jeff. And he had the opportunity to sit in on their daily meetings and calls. He received more training so he could even become a mentor. And best of all, he would get guidance from the top dog at Lighthouse, who was a guy called Paul War. South African guy. Super successful multimillionaire who had Bill Gates and Warren Buffett on speed dial, apparently.
Did he?
Just seemed really impressive to Jeff, and he threw himself into it. I think partly, I imagine, because he was excited to soak up the knowledge from all these really successful people that he wanted to kind of model himself on, but also he'd spent 35 fucking thousand at this point. So I think he probably felt like he needed to get something out of this.
Yeah, sure.
And all of this was happening through COVID. So, you know, he did have the time to put into this. And bit by bit, Lighthouse did take over Jeff's life. Every morning, 5 a.m., he would jump on calls. And he was, you know, on there talking it up. And within 6 months, the calls were going on from 5 a.m. until 10 at night. Dawn never saw Jeff. He was holed up in his room on his laptop. And not just on calls, he was transcribing everything that Paul War, the top dog, was saying. Everything was recorded, audio, everything was transcribed.
Oh, this is like Nixon.
Very Nixon. Yes. Exactly, exactly, exactly. And it was relentless. And Jeff had no time off. He wasn't allowed. When the journalist, Katrin Nye, was looking into some of these transcripts, Paul War's ideas were kind of weird because there wasn't much about business success and getting ahead. It was all about the levels, where everyone apparently falls into one of four levels of spiritual development. Level one is this kind of chaotic childlike state, whereas level four was like you are fully conscious and present, you're free from fear. And if you want to be successful, Paul said you had to get out of level one and get to level four. And that was the only thing that mattered. None of your ambitions, nothing else mattered. All of that could not be achieved if you were on level one. You had to get to level four. Of course, Lighthouse was the only one that could help you get there. But Jeff was told he was a level one and he needed weeks and weeks of work, personal work, to get to level four before he'd be in this position to achieve his goals. But getting to level four is not easy. And weeks became months and months and months. And then it became a year and more. And there wasn't any progression on Jeff's personal goals or even getting past level one.
Right.
It was all about, it was brainwashing, all of this stuff.
Yes.
He was on these calls, not just with Paul and Jay. It was like 30 other people all on these huge group calls for hours and hours and hours. They weren't allowed to leave. And when Jeff was expressing to Jay any kind of personal frustration about, I want to get to level four, Jay would be like, come on, mate. You know, you're frustrated because you're being emotionally lazy. Step up. Turns out there was only one person at Lighthouse who was on level four. And that's Paul War, the boss, the big top dog. Everyone else, including Jay and Jeff, they were all stuck at level one.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise.
I know. And not to diss anyone at Lighthouse because...
We're not dissing them.
No, but the thing I'm about to say is not a diss because I understand that they were all being like classically brainwashed with these cult techniques like isolation, removing them from friends and family, indoctrination. But I have to say, if you're handing over cash for self-improvement and you're told that all the things you want to achieve need to be put on hold until you become a level four, that's a big fucking red flag.
Yes.
But they were balls deep in this cult, Geordie. You know, they were not able to see this flag. And they were also told that the main reason they were all stuck at level one was because of the negative influences around them. And that basically the biggest obstacle and hurdle to getting to level four is friends and family. They're the ones holding you back. You had to ditch them. Ditch your family, ditch your friends, ditch your wife, your girlfriend, whoever. And put everything into Lighthouse. Your time, your money.
Total isolation.
Paul War was saying that families are narcissistic and controlling and they're dangerous. And you have to, you know, abandon ship if you want to move up the levels. This podcast actually looked at a woman called Erin, not her real name, who also became a Lighthouse Associate Elect. So she'd obviously given a lot of money as well. She was there at the same time as Jeff. And she joined after a messy divorce where she thought Lighthouse was going to put her on a good personal and business path. But all the savvy business chat that reeled her in about success and leadership, it all fell away and it ended up getting really personal. The Lighthouse leaders were getting her to like reveal stuff about difficult things that had happened to her in her past, including being sexually abused at the age of 13 by a family friend. Lighthouse were really egging her on to take her parents to court and make them pay for not taking better care of her when she was a kid. They wanted her to sue her parents so she could basically invest that money back into Lighthouse and get her up the levels. Oh, yeah, it's fucking evil. Erin and Jeff are not the only ones with fucked up stories about Lighthouse, because the BBC spoke to like more than 20 people who'd all managed to get out of Lighthouse who all had similar shit happen to them. They thought they were joining a mentoring group for career change and they all loved it at the beginning, but then they were pressured to invest more and more. They were having the leaders dig into personal shit from their backgrounds and they were all told they had to let go of their toxic families and go deep into Lighthouse. And there's even this one guy called Anthony Church who had struggled with anxiety and depression. He'd had a breakdown. He tried to take his own life. And then Jay got him involved in Lighthouse, convinced him he had to pay $5,000 for coaching. So he did. He handed over the $5,000. And during the coaching, Jay convinced Anthony that part of what was holding him back was his medication that he was on for depression, anxiety, all of this stuff. So Jay then gave him coaching on what to tell his doctors to convince the doctors that his mental health was fine, he was really was massively improved, and that he didn't need medication.
Oh, God.
So he went to his doctor, said all the shit that Jay told him to say, and the doctor agreed to reduce the medication. But it did not go well for Anthony because he started losing his shit and getting withdrawal symptoms. And Jay was like, look, this is all part of the process. You know, you're not going to get better until you get worse. And it wasn't good. You know, Anthony started to get really depressed again, a lot of suicidal thoughts. It's just fucked up. You know, the thing with Lighthouse and loads of life coaches, and including Jay, is that, you know, in the UK, I'm not sure about Australia, but definitely in the UK,
it's not regulated. Yeah,
exactly. It's unregulated. No qualifications needed. Anyone can be a life coach with no training.
That is changing because obviously as a trainee counsellor, I know that there's something called SCOPED, which is actually going to include that now. Life coaching is going to be included in that, which means people looking for life coaches and counsellors need to be aware that they have to be registered with an approved governing body, of which there are about three or four that are okay.
Okay.
Outside of that, you're advised not to go there. But that doesn't stop them from advertising themselves, and it doesn't stop them from getting clients. And those who already have the clients continue on. But it just means that as a potential client of a life coach or a counsellor, you need to do your research by making sure that they are a member of an approved governing body.
Well, the thing is, there is no approved governing body at the moment, and certainly not in 2020.
No, not then, but there is now.
Yeah. And there are thousands of people claiming to be life coaches in the UK with no qualifications. Jay is one of them. And he's telling this guy, get off your meds.
It's outrageous. I mean, a life coach shouldn't be telling you that anyway, or a counsellor. They should not be telling you that. Just in case you didn't already realise, listeners.
And top dog, Paul War, and this is a quote, he says, what qualifies us is experience. Mentoring isn't a qualification. It's an experiential thing. Do you know what? I think that to a point, if you go into a business and you're shadowing a leader and you're learning on the job, learning how to do someone else's job by shadowing, watching and asking questions, that's experiential. But going to somebody who's just saying, do this, by the way, there are levels and get off your meds. No. That's just fucking evil. Yes,
that is just dictatorial and it's not okay. It's coercive.
It's dictatorial and any dickhead can start mentoring you and convince you to part with your money and invest in yourself. Mm. When people were handing over their money, Geordie, they were all told different things about what was happening to their money. So some of them thought their investment, it was always called an investment, mm-hmm. was for mentoring that would kind of, you know, change their lives and give an opportunity to make more money. Some were told that their money was going to go to charity work in Africa, but pretty much everyone at Lighthouse was pressured to get money any way possible. Some people were told, go and borrow money from the bank. Other people were told, go get a credit card so you can pay for the courses.
That's terrible. Oh my God.
Yeah, but it gets worse, Geordie, because poor old Jeff, well, he stopped working to focus on Lighthouse full time. And to pay for the courses and mentoring, he sold his house, Geordie.
Oh no.
Yep. He basically invested / threw away more than £130,000.
God.
And of course, no business opportunities ever came from Lighthouse. It was all money in, nothing coming back. And it took 2 years and all of that cash. Actually, on the documentary, his poor girlfriend, Dawn, she's like, I knew he was going to sell his house. He was so deep into it and there was nothing I could say. Nothing I could say because everything would get twisted around. It did take 2 years for Jeff to finally think, what the fuck is going on here? And to finally have some doubts about Lighthouse. When he hinted to Lighthouse that he was thinking of quitting, they fucking turned on him.
Yeah.
And they'd done it before to other people, because when Anthony, who was told to get off the meds, started to question Lighthouse, Jay told him that he was being paranoid, it was all part of the medication withdrawal, and it was all in his mind. He left anyway. He then realized he'd been in a cult.
Yeah.
And he started sending other people in Lighthouse information about cults. And then Jay was like, I'm going to threaten you with police and legal action. So it got really nasty. Another woman called Jo, who was in Lighthouse, realized the whole thing was a sham and a cult. And when she backed out, she wrote about it online, trying to warn people. And in retaliation, Lighthouse contacted the school where she worked, made up shit about her and told them she was a danger to children. She was suspended and basically had her career, her teaching career, go down the toilet for a while. And then when Erin queried Lighthouse about where her money had gone, Paul Waugh basically said to her, we've got recordings of you talking about your sexual abuse and we'll go public with it. When Erin did finally leave Lighthouse, Paul Waugh went on YouTube, named her, talked about her sexual abuse, and it was out there for everyone.
Oh my God, that man is horrific.
Yep. Eventually, they edited out her name because they had been warned that you're not allowed to identify a victim of sexual abuse without their consent. It's a criminal offense, apparently. Yes. So the story is out there. Her name got edited out.
God.
For Jeff, the straw that broke the camel's back came when he had to beg Lighthouse for time off to go visit his dad in America. And he had to give them 28 grand, basically. And they said, okay, you can take 2 weeks off to go to America. The trip came at a good time because they were trying to get him to leave Dawn and go and live in a communal house with other Lighthouse members. He went off to America, and this is a quote from him. He says, when I came back, I knew I'd have to go back on the daily calls with Lighthouse and that I would have to commit to them for good. I knew I'd never get that time off again, and it would be 7 days a week forever. But I also knew I wasn't happy there. My hair was falling out. I was stressed. I was on the computer and phone all day, which I hated. I was stuck speaking to people that I didn't respect. It stressed me out so much because I had invested so much, and intuitively I knew I wouldn't see that money again.
Mm.
2 weeks away gave him some clarity, and he could actually see he was doing nothing. He wasn't learning. He wasn't making money. He wasn't working. He wasn't achieving his career goals or his personal goals. He was isolated from Dawn and his family. They were telling him that Dawn was evil, and the stuff they were saying about Dawn was awful. They were saying things like, so Jeff was on a call with Paul Waugh, and you hear this in documentary. He says things to Jeff like, one day you'll snap. People like you murder. You'll murder a woman like her. You know that? It's very common. Or they'd say things like, you may love her, but she doesn't love you no matter what she says.
Yeah.
It's really awful.
Trying to get into his brain.
Mm. So eventually he said, I'm quitting and I want my 28 grand back. They were like, we are going to take you and your girlfriend down. And that's when shit, you know, really went bad for Jeff and Dawn. They went to Dawn's employers and said that she was an internet bully and a troll. They slandered her. It was really awful.
Oh, no.
Basically, the whole thing was a very nasty experience. So when finally the BBC were looking into the whole of Lighthouse, it turns out the whole time the BBC were doing this investigation, there was a secret investigation ordered by the UK Secretary of State for Business. They were carrying out their own investigation at the same time. And in February 2023, the UK government made an application to close down Lighthouse because they'd been investigating the cult since June 2022. They decided that Lighthouse was working against the public interest. They were not keeping proper records. They were not paying tax. And they couldn't even identify what Lighthouse did as a company. They closed it down. And the whole thing went into receivership. But despite the fact that they were shut down, Paul Waugh started a new organization called Lighthouse International Group Holdings. No, sorry.
Why couldn't he have been arrested?
He didn't get arrested. He just got shut down.
Oh, God.
No, and so anyway, sorry. He started a new one called Lighthouse Global. They're rebranding and they're using God as their new hook. So they're focusing on Christianity rather than self-help. No. They are promising to use their 18 years of wisdom and personal development and connect Christ with self-help, and they're still going. Just a new name.
They sound appalling. Oh, well, thank you for telling me. So now I know to avoid Lighthouse Global.
Yes.
That's awful, Michelle.
So please be careful. It's not a self-help. It's not mentoring. It's a cult.
Warning, warning, warning. Thanks, Michelle. That is a warning from the tippy-tippy top. I hope no one else falls for it. Yeah, that's terrible. Speaking of people falling for things, I've got something which isn't really a cult that was sent to me by aforementioned chappie Charlene, our fan of our show. She loves the Grace episodes. And she asked if we had ever heard of the McDonald's strip search scam.
No.
Has you? I hadn't.
It didn't exist when I was in my...
When you were flipping burgers?
When I was flipping burgers and in my polyester maroon and white outfit, which turned to lime green at some point.
Oh, what, while you were employed? Who had to pay for the uniform? Hopefully not you.
No, they gave them to you all and then included. You handed them in. Yes, all included, because they wanted to make sure, you know, those 14-year-old people were actually wearing clean uniforms, because if you expect a 14, 15-year-old to wash a McDonald's uniform, it's not going to happen.
That's terrible. Oh, God. But listen, this strip scam is weird and I'm going to do my absolute best to try and explain it. And it is basically what it says on the tin. There was a series of incidents, mostly in rural areas of the United States, over a period of about 10 years that started in 1994, where a man calling a restaurant or grocery store, doesn't have to be McDonald's, would claim to be a police officer before using his powers of persuasion, much like your Paul Waugh, to convince managers of the store to conduct strip searches of their employees and sometimes even customers.
Hang on. Someone's on the phone.
Do you get it? Yeah.
A fake. We're the police.
Yeah.
We're concerned about something, I guess.
We have reason to believe that there is a customer or one of your employees in your staff today on duty or whatever, and somehow they get to describe someone loosely, and of course they'll go, oh, you mean Charlene? Obviously, Charlene, it wasn't you. But then they will say, oh, it must be this person. They'll go, yep, that's it. That's them. They've been stealing money. They've been doing X, Y, Z, whatever. And then this person on the phone manages to groom or manipulate the person on the other end of the phone, usually a young manager of some kind, to get the suspect, in inverted commas, so just the poor unsuspecting member of staff or customer, to perform bizarre and humiliating acts on behalf of the police. It's hard to get your head around, Michelle, but more than 70 phone calls were actually made across 30 states. And usually these calls were made to fast food restaurants in small towns. And the reason for this will become clear as I explain.
I keep thinking, what's in it for the caller? Nothing. It's a gag. Like, what, do they just get their rocks off on this? Like, I don't get it at all.
Listen on. Well, and maybe more will be revealed. I actually got a rundown of several of the incidents thanks to Wikipedia. And in 1994, when the first one that happened, this man claiming to be a sheriff's deputy called a McDonald's restaurant in Ohio, telling the manager that a customer's purse was stolen from the restaurant and told two young female workers at the restaurant to allow the manager to strip search them.
Oh my God.
And I guess they complied because they thought that they were doing the right thing. Then in 1995, a man claiming to be a deputy sheriff called a Pizza Hut in Mississippi and again accused an employee of stealing money from a restaurant customer. The manager of the restaurant was summoned to the restaurant. He wasn't on duty that day, or they weren't on duty that day, in order to strip search the employee. Everyone is taking the demands very seriously. In 1999, a manager for Burger King in Fargo, North Dakota, was manipulated into slapping the bare ass of a 17-year-old female employee.
I'm sorry, I
shouldn't
laugh.
After being instructed, don't laugh, by someone on the phone claiming to be a police officer. And if that sounds bizarre, Michelle, wait till you hear what I've got to tell you. There's so many
more. I just can't believe that...
That people would do it
because it's someone on a phone. And come on, we've all made prank calls like... Hi, is your fridge running? You better go catch it. All that bullshit. You don't know who's on the end of the phone. They're certainly not showing a badge. Nothing.
No, they're not. And this is the problem. So it might be a good idea to explain at this point that these are small towns.
Yeah.
None of them were bigger cities. So not many opportunities for passers-by with more sense to intervene. And the majority of staff in these establishments, as you yourself will know, Michelle, being an ex-employee of McDonald's at 12, that they're young.
Yeah.
They're all very, very young.
Well, and I even lied. I lied about my age to get a job at McDonald's. I said I was 3 months older than I was so I could start working. I was 13, for fuck's sake, and I looked 9. It was ridiculous.
Wow. Well, listen, there's more. In 1999, in Blackfoot, Idaho, a 16-year-old female server working at a local pizza joint was taken to the manager's office after a phone call was made by someone claiming to be Officer Davis of the Blackfoot Police and accused an employee of stealing a woman's wallet with a $50 bill in it. And the caller convinced the manager to strip search this employee, the young 16-year-old girl, to provide a detailed description on the phone, Michelle, of her naked body, including her breasts and genitals. And this only ended when a male colleague of the victim came into the room and intervened. He confronted the officer on the phone and the caller hung up.
Oh my God. This is disgusting. It's so awful.
It sounds simplistic the way I'm telling it, but obviously it was over a long period of time each time. And the way that the person on the other end of the phone would convince them to do these things was by gaining their trust and coming up with some outlandish story. Yep. And, you know, proof. We need proof of, you know, the fact that she hasn't stuck $50 up her fanny or whatever. I don't know.
Oh, my God. And also, I guess they're using psychological techniques and just making them feel like there is really something at stake, something on the line here. But
well, exactly. Like, for example, in 2000, a female McDonald's manager in Kentucky was convinced by the fraudulent caller claiming to be police that they were tracking down a suspected sex offender and he was in her restaurant.
No.
And they got her, this caller, got her to undress in front of a customer to act as a honey trap. Because this customer was supposed to be the sex offender.
No.
So she was convinced that she had to lure him by undressing and then the police were going to come and arrest this guy. She thought she was doing the right thing.
This is horrible.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
In 2001, the manager of a Hooters restaurant.
Okay.
Which, I mean, aren't they already boobies out anyway?
Yeah.
Isn't that what it's about?
Topless waitresses. Hooters.
I thought so. Anyway, this manager of a Hooters restaurant in a small town in West Virginia told two female employees that a police officer had called the restaurant and reported a stolen change wallet. So obviously, you know, from a customer or a change wallet probably that they're using to take orders.
Okay.
So it's, you know, company fraud. The caller had the manager insist that the women strip and threatened them with arrest if they didn't comply.
Oh, my God.
2001, a supervisor for an Indianapolis area Burger King strip searched a part-time 15-year-old employee, female, in front of a male co-worker after a call was made to the business by a policeman claiming an employee stole a wallet. The caller asked for a description of the employee's hair and tan lines. The search was also conducted, allegedly, in a room where other team members could observe. This is so damaging to that poor victim.
Of course.
The trauma of this incident, the shame, the embarrassment, the lifelong, you know, issues that they will have to deal with, their mental health, is appalling.
And especially as initially they've been accused of theft.
That as well.
That as well. And then they've been thrown into this awful situation. This is fucked.
There's more.
No.
2002, an 18-year-old female McDonald's employee in Iowa on her first day on the job was forced to strip naked and jog on the spot and then hold different degrading poses when the caller struck at that particular McDonald's.
Jesus. At what point do you just go, fuck off, mate? You're not even here. You're on the phone. I don't give a fuck.
At which point? Well, maybe there are loads of incidences that weren't reported because they just went, oh, fuck off, you know. But on the whole, this is a litany of incidents that did occur and it's not out in the open. People aren't saying, calling other McDonald's and saying, watch out, there's a creep getting you to do things in the name of the police. Always ask for them to come to the store if there's an issue.
Yeah.
But they didn't. Yeah. And in 2002, a manager for a Taco Bell restaurant in a small town in Georgia received a call from a detective, in inverted commas, claiming that a wallet had been stolen from the lobby. The manager was given a description of the employee. It was supposedly a 19-year-old woman, and the manager was groomed into taking her into the manager's office, where he stripped her of her uniform, read the clothing tags to the caller and put the clothes in a safe so she couldn't get to them. The caller also managed to convince the manager to force the employee to exercise before rubbing and inspecting her body, including intimate areas.
No. Oh, my God.
Imagine how you feel once you realize you'd been duped and you know, completely led up the garden path. I mean, there must have been in some sort of fugue. But not just that, the victim. I'm talking about the manager who is perpetrating this actual hands-on search.
Yeah.
The manager was also told that this was to see if any sweat had revealed signs of green residue on her body, which would prove she'd been in contact with the supposedly stolen money. So there's always some stupid excuse or stupid explanation.
Sounds fucking ridiculous.
2003, Iowa. An Applebee's assistant manager subjected a waitress to a 90-minute strip search after receiving a reverse charge call from someone who represented themselves as a regional manager of Applebee's. Then in 2003, a call was made to a Taco Bell manager in Juneau, Alaska, claiming to be working for the Taco Bell investigating drug abuse at the restaurant. And the manager was manipulated into picking out, this is appalling, a 14-year-old female customer who he was told was the suspect and to strip search her as well as have her perform several lewd acts at the caller's request.
No.
This is absolutely fucking appalling. In 2003, this caller was becoming increasingly bold, obviously. Then there was a Hardee's manager in South Dakota who was convinced by the caller to be police to strip search a female employee and hold her against her will in the office for 3 hours because she'd apparently stolen money from a customer. The manager searched her and found nothing. So the caller then instructed the manager to check the employee for drugs and had the manager touch intimate areas of the victim's body, as well as making her sit on his lap and kneel in front of him while he looked in her hair, ears and mouth.
Geordie, I don't think I can hear more of these.
It's awful, isn't it? Well, I'm going to cut short because it goes on and on.
Oh,
I mean, there
God.
Were grocery stores, there were restaurants, there was Blockbuster video stores, and the staff kept complying. And then in February 2004, 4 places were hit in one night. But the real doozy, and the one that Charlene highlighted in her email to us, was the Mount Washington incident in Kentucky. A male caller who identified himself as a police officer contacted the manager of the McDonald's, Donna Summer, not that Donna Summer, obviously, but the manager of this Kentucky one, McDonald's. Donna was convinced that she was to detain an 18-year-old female employee called Louise Ogborn, who was suspected of theft. The caller instructed Donna to make the poor girl strip down layer by layer and make sure she wasn't hiding the money on her person. and once she was naked, she was handed an apron to cover herself. Then another employee was then tasked with bagging up Louise's clothes and moving them to the manager's car, Donna Summer's car, which meant she was stuck in the room completely naked. The caller then manipulated Donna into performing a cavity search on Louise with the help of one of the male cooks, but the male cook left after an hour. Donna was coming in and out of the office all this time, and every time she asked the caller, why is this taking so long, he had some sort of convincing reply. He'd say things like, we're on our way, we just don't have enough people working with us today, just bear with us, which to Donna sounded legitimate. However, she needed to get back to work, and the officer said, do you have a man in your life who you trust, someone like a boyfriend or a husband who you could get in to maybe watch over the suspect while we get there?
Oh my God, I can't even imagine where this is going now.
Donna called in her fiancé, Walter Nix Jr., to assist further, and this is where it gets dark, so trigger warning. When Donna left the room, Walter Nix Jr. was instructed by the caller to smell Louise's breath and ask her to kiss him. Then she was instructed to show her genitals to Walter to prove she had not hidden the $50 bill there. And Louise was later reported as saying, I didn't know what was behind the door. I didn't know if anyone was waiting for me, and I didn't want to run out naked. I was really scared. The caller was telling me to say, yes, sir, no, sir. And if I didn't do it, I'd get punished. I was petrified.
Well, she was already being punished, you know?
She was. Of course she was. This abuse went on for 3.5 hours, and Louise was scared for her life. CCTV footage of the ordeal saw a visibly distraught Louise bursting into tears and wiping her eyes several times throughout the call, which is absolutely heartbreaking. And during the time they spent in the room, it was revealed that Louise was also coerced into giving oral sex to Walter Nix Jr. in order to avoid punishment. Once Nix Jr. left the room after the 3 hours of all this debauchery, he called a friend and told them, I've done something terribly bad.
He knew. Yeah.
He knew.
Oh,
eventually, Donna, the manager, called the management, who were apparently aware of the police calling, and they were completely in the dark about it. They said no. And then she realized, she said, no one has ordered the police to do this. We don't know anything about it. Oh, Donna then realized it was a terrible hoax, but the caller had hung up, except a quick-thinking employee dialed 69, which in America must be the number, like star 69, to get the last caller's number before anyone else could call the restaurant, which helped the police investigation. Poor Louise was then released from the office, wrapped in a blanket, and Walter Nix Jr. was charged with sexual assault, while officers began to look into the man behind the call and find out who he could be. And when Donna looked at the CCTV and saw what Walter had subjected Louise to, she, of course, broke off their engagement.
Yep.
And poor Louise underwent therapy and had to have medication to deal with the associated trauma. It's absolutely heartbreaking. This awful person, I tell you what. The investigation led to the arrest of a married father of five, David Richard Stewart of Florida. I've named him. At the time that he was arrested, David Richard Stewart, I've named him again, was a security guard at a Walmart in Panama City in Florida. And a search of Stewart's trailer revealed guns, police paraphernalia, and training manuals. And police said they discovered that Stewart had attended a local police academy and volunteered as a deputy with a small police department in Western Florida. In June 2004, Stewart was extradited to Kentucky and charged with solicitation of sodomy. Oh. So at some point that had happened, and impersonating a police officer. And facing a possible 15 years in prison, he pleaded not guilty to all charges and was acquitted of all of them.
What?
In the Mount Washington case, despite evidence of phone cards that were linked to some of the calls being found in his home and co-workers identifying him on CCTV purchasing the cards that were linked to the calls.
Oh my God, he got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these poor people, the victims in his wake, are traumatized. This is fucked. It always goes to show, even if you're guilty of something, get a good lawyer, you might get off.
That's not really great advice for everyone though, Michelle. We don't want that to happen, really, do we?
No, but anything can happen in a trial.
So police reported that the scam calls ended after Stewart's arrest.
Mm.
So I would say it's a fairly good guess that it was him. And if you want to know more, there's a documentary called Pervert, Hunting the Strip Search Caller on Paramount Plus.
Okay.
And there's also another one, which is a Netflix doc called Don't Pick Up the Phone.
Oof.
Why? If indeed it was him, and we are assuming that it was, I went onto a few different websites like Women's Aid, and I found this about coercive control. Not just why did he do it, but why did they follow his instructions? And on the website at Women's Aid, it says, coercive control is an act or a pattern of acts of assault, threats, humiliation, intimidation, or other abuse that is used to harm, punish, or frighten their victim. Coercive control creates invisible chains and a sense of fear. That's where he was coming from.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, he just wanted to intimidate and control somebody.
Clearly. And he was also standing in a phone box outside the restaurants on most occasions, so he could see what was going on.
Okay.
In answer to your earlier question, Oxford Academic says coercion, manipulation, and exploitation all refer to problematic behavior. However, coercion is understood as having no acceptable choice. Manipulation is the steering of or influencing of the choices by others by means that might be morally problematic.
Yeah.
And three forms of manipulation are distinguished: deception, pressuring, and employing emotional vulnerability or character defects. And exploitation involves exploiting others' vulnerabilities for one's own ends. And all three concepts raise issues related to the value of freedom, conceived as the independence of one's choices from the will of others. It's a convoluted way of saying basically they were given no other choice, the receivers of the calls.
In their mind.
In their minds.
Because obviously hang up the phone is a choice.
Is the choice, exactly. But they were worried about getting in trouble. Yeah, they went along with it. Even when it got so dark and so morally wrong. They reminded me of something, Michelle. A couple of things, actually, which I've got to talk about. The Stanford Prison Experiment. You may remember that. It was an unethical psychology experiment that was conducted in 1971. It was supposed to be a 2-week simulation of a prison environment where the participants were recruited from the local community with an ad in the newspapers offering $15 a day to male students who wanted to take part in this psychological study of prison life. Volunteers were randomly assigned to being either a prisoner or a prison guard. However, the experiment had to end after 6 days because the psychological abuse of the prisoners by the guards became increasingly brutal. They just piled on.
Yeah, it's a very famous study and really fucking shocking. Wasn't there something like, if you had blue eyes, you were going to be a prisoner, and if you had brown eyes, you were the guard?
Not sure.
You know, it was very random. There was no rhyme or reason why you were one or the other. But yeah, it got dark. Yeah. It got Lord of the Flies pretty quick.
Yeah. Mm. Another study of why humans comply in what appears to be a morally ambiguous manner is the Milgram experiment from 1961, 10 years earlier than the Stanford Prison Experiment. And this was a series of social psychology experiments conducted by Yale University psychologist Stanley Milgram to measure the willingness of study participants to obey an authority figure who instructed them to perform acts conflicting with their personal conscience. The participants were told that they were assisting an unrelated experiment in which they had to administer electric shocks to a learner, and they were told that these fake electric shocks were gradually being increased to a fatal level if they had been real, but they were told they were not real. Except there were actors who were pretending to be shocked, and it became confusing.
And screaming as well. There's all that screaming that people could hear. Yeah.
Yeah. And there was a really high proportion of subjects who would actually fully obey the instructions, with every participant going up to 300 volts and 65% going up to the full 450 volts. That's a lot of people. This study began 3 months after the start of the trial of the German Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem, and it was to see why
Nazis complied with Hitler's requests.
Exactly. Were they just following orders, or were they accomplices? That kind of question, that moral question there. It was said that some of the subjects were uncomfortable administering the shocks, and they would show signs of stress and tension. But basically, on the whole, they just went for it and pressed those buzzers, which is weird, right?
You know what you're doing is wrong, but you're putting your fear of disobeying authority first, and what the consequences might be for you if you don't do it.
Well, yeah, we don't know because we weren't there, but it's a way of trying to understand the horror, I suppose. And if you want to know more about the Milgram experiment, he made a documentary called Obedience, which shows the experiment and its results. So hop onto YouTube, see if you can find it, if you can bear any more horror.
Well, maybe I'll try and link that up on the Patreon. Absolutely awful stories. Thanks Charlene.
And that was stunning, really, to believe that even happened. I just thought it was all going to be a massive hoax, but actually it went far, 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 far.
Beyond, yeah. And beyond. I struggle to understand why people would, A, like, strip, why you just wouldn't go, fuck off, I'm not stripping, no. Get a freaking policeman in exactly. here. There are people who are conflict avoidant. They yes. are scared of authority. They're good girls, good boys, you know, they do what they're told and... Yeah, it ends up like that. That is fucking horrific. Thank you for sharing. Gonna have nightmares.
I'm sorry about that. I hope you don't. On that bright and breezy note, yeah. a nightmarish note, I want to thank you all for listening. And as usual, we're going to say our last final three things.
Wherever you are.
Wherever you. Whatever. What?
What do whatever I say? You do.
Whatever you do.
Wherever you are, whatever you do.
Just keep eavesdropping.
Eavesdropping.